One of the enduring aspects of 40K and the story of humanity from M30 to M41 is the endless dance that exists between solid certainty and speculation. As I've spoken to many times, in the lore, what is stated as truth can always remain suspect. For even when something is spoken to with weight, the singularity of its description may suggest it as being half-truth, propaganda, or the fractured memory of a dying hero, the manipulations of some other warp entity even. All of this, though, is by design. The mystery embedded within the grim darkness of the far future is what fuels the verse of 40K. And I feel more often than not, what can be learned from what is not said can eclipse those storylines which are in fact resolved. It's the knowledge gaps that are incrementally driven wider which seem to enthrall the most, because I think we all see that the true horror which drags down the hopes of humanity sits not within those nightmares which are all too visible, but it's in the mysteries which somehow we all understand will never be known. One of those mysteries was the Terminus Decree. Now, no longer. Okay, so before we get to the lore of the matter, this is one of those things that has to be painfully contextualized through both lore and actual real-world material, because there's no other way to really analyze this situation. We're going to be dragged kicking and screaming from the immersive into the cold light of day, and how bright and horrible it is. And this section ended up being longer than I intended it to be. I make no apology for that within the context of this subject, because it's appropriate, and that fact hopefully will not be a shocking revelation for any long-time viewers. So really, we have to just get straight to what this is, and there's really no other word for it, unfortunately, other than drama. For those who don't know, the Terminus Decree was long established as this mystery end times order that in the darkest hour for humanity would be revealed by the Grey Knights, and thus enact some kind of extreme ultimate action. Understandably, speculation about this was significant given that it first emerged back in the 5th edition of 40K and seemed to be either of devastating consequence or imperial myth. One of those things. In the past, the old reference point described the Terminus as deep within the chambers of purity, locked away in the chamber said to hold the tomb of the Sigillite himself, rests a simple wooden box, embellished with a golden seal. Within this box, written upon parchment, is the instruction known only as the Terminus Decree. This artifact goes unrecorded in all the libraries of the Imperium, for it has been kept secret from all but the Supreme Grand Masters of the Chapter. Only a Supreme Grand Master of the Grey Knights knows how to open the box, and he will do so only when all hope for the future of humanity seems lost. The Terminus Decree is the ultimate sanction, remember that word, of the Grey Knights, a secret so vast it could bring the Imperium to its knees or save it in its darkest hour. The exact nature of the document is unknown, and the only clue to its contents lies in the box's golden seal. It is whispered that it is the exact match of another seal found only in one place in all the Imperium's many scattered worlds, the Emperor's Golden Throne. Now, for those who have finished and read The Siege of Terror, there is a massive amount of implication made in this past reference, and it's very difficult to believe that obviously when the authors were constructing The Siege of Terror and creating the characters and the events which would unfold, they didn't make a pointed reference to many of these things here, like the fact that the word sanction is mentioned, the golden seal, which we now understand is a destruct mechanism that only Vulcan can operate. And so all of these elements coming together really point to something very significant, but also something which connects to the events, characters, and era of basically the Heresy. However, now in the newest 10th edition codex for 40K, we got seemingly out of nowhere this new description of the Terminus that has people foaming at the mouth. Because the new description, which I'm sure many of you have already heard, states that held in a simple wooden box that only the Supreme Grand Master may open, the Terminus Decree details the Emperor's final command to the Grey Knights chapter. The Master of Mankind can never be allowed to leave the Golden Throne, either returned to life, reborn in another's body, or ascend as some kind of warp entity. And if he does, the Grey Knights must return him to his terrible duty. Indeed, they were created with the possibility, I think the word possibility is doing some pretty heavy lifting there, of this event in mind. A task beyond the abilities of any other force in the Imperium. I think many would argue beyond the abilities of anything in the Imperium for that matter. The decree offers no guidance on how such feats might be achieved, which is very convenient, for it is neither a weapon nor a magic formula, which I think, again, that is a very pointed knife twist. Rather, the Grey Knights would themselves be the weapon on such a desperate day, one that would likely have to cut a path through the ranks of the Custodian Guard and many others to see its duty done. Which makes no sense, that last section there. Why would the Custodian Guard have to be cut through if this is a decree by the Emperor? Anyway, so the divulging of significant events or information through the medium of Codex books has always been somewhat controversial, or at least somewhat divisive, because I think for reasons that are entirely illustrated in this topic today. Because yes, they are a great foundational tool for anybody new to a faction, or who have, for example, just loved the look of the Necrons, the Blood Angels. They're coming into 40k and they're thinking, yes, these are the ones for me. You grab a codex, you've got your rules, your lore. Admittedly, the rules aspect is a bit of a point of contention on its own at this point, but that's an entirely other video. Anyway, historically, that's how it worked. You were like, I like these guys, I've got the book for them now. Now I understand what it's all about. Because in essence, a codex should contain the faction lore in brief. And there's no reason why you couldn't alongside that add in some just juicy, interesting mysteries, points of reference, other oddities related to that faction. In fact, those flavorful little moments are all part of getting to know a faction. As a kid, teenager, I remember poring over those little details, thinking about them, feeling ever more invigorated and inspired by them. But their inclusion should come with a big caveat, that being, who is going to see this, and therefore how pivotal that information reveal needs to be. Because with this new Terminus decree, it contradicts everything that's been established, and it's bolstered by having no expanded reference points or explanations. There's no additional connected narrative in other pages. They also, just adjacently, retire poor Kaldor Drago, who had been really inextricably linked to the Terminus for basically all of the Grey Knight's history. His was a character arc that had been built up over many years. In recent memories of 8th edition, it described how, with the Grey Knight's forces stretched thinner than ever, Drago appears to each of the Grand Masters to ask their counsel, and for the first time in the chapter's history, a particularly dire strategy is now being given consideration, the Terminus Decree. So there was a lot of talk about the Terminus Decree and if it was going to be implemented, and you've got the Cicatrix Maledictum, you've got the Emperor appearing to return and become empowered. So there was this thought about, okay, so what's happening with the Terminus Decree? And I think also for Grey Knights players, there was a lot of invested emotion in the sense of, what's Drago's sort of ultimate endpoint going to be? Oh yeah, well, he's gone now. At least in tabletop miniature form, anyway. But as I've stated before, for better or worse, the lore and miniatures are inextricably linked together, because Drago was, and I suppose is still, for now, the Supreme Grand Master of the Grey Knights. He's their leader, he's had this journey and story which remains epic, he's got the Titan Sword, which is said to have been forged by the Emperor himself, he's successfully defeated Mortarion in the past, something notably even Gilliman was unable to achieve, although admittedly, that was by Drago speaking his true name to Mortarion, which is a demon Primarch, then just shattered him back to the warp, so he didn't really kind of best him in combat as such. And in the 8th edition, it was talking about him being able to escape the warp for ever longer periods of time, and that now, by degrees, he was able to lead the Grey Knights again, so there was some hope for his full return. which would have been obviously very dramatic and interesting. But no, forget all that, because now it states that despite his efforts to return, he is now instead being continually dragged back into the warp, basically the total opposite of what was happening before, somehow. The Grey Knights are basically now just sick and tired of him as well. He's coming and going all the time. Oh yeah, Drago's off on another warp holiday. And now, because of his continually unplanned absences, they don't think that's acceptable. And if they can't find a solution, they're just going to find somebody else to lead them. And unfortunately, because he's been removed from the Codex as a model, that seems very likely to be on the cards. So this resolution for Drago is pretty disappointing, I think, for many people, given the established, I will say, decade of narrative that's been attached to him as this epic character who would one day, he'd been walking in the warp, and one day he would return to the Grey Knights and maybe enact the Terminus Decree. Well, now that's not going to happen. There is a small caveat, which is, as with anything 40k, you never know. And similarly to how Yarak disappeared, maybe he'll come back in some form. But as it stands, no. Now with the Terminus situation, it's even more neck-breakingly jarring, because you'd imagine that such earth-shattering revelations would be revealed in some epic narrative saga, one that gives us fleshed-out details, character motivations, expanded parameters of adjacent events which give context and weight to it. But as it is, the more you find yourself wondering why this, you add all the pieces together to try and make them fit in any possible way, and when you eventually can't make any really grounded sense of it other than scenarios which require a pretty solid suspension of disbelief, people don't like that. And the more we dive into it, the more strange it becomes, because even if it was intended as some kind of misdirect, as can happen in 40k, some Imperial adept made a vast misinterpretation of whatever avatar you want to use as an unreliable narrator, we return to that question of, well, should that be happening in a codex? I mean, I feel like probably not, but on the other hand, I guess it's kind of established for the longest time that codex books can do that. I think my first rebuttal to that point, though, would be, sure, but in the past, there was a lot more focus on a codex being like a delivery system for lore. But now you've got the entire Black Library producing narrative on a scale which is pretty unprecedented when it comes to 40k. And the thing is, these days, you have people who are just interested in the lore, and come hell or high water, they're only going to be interested in the lore. So then, is it reasonable that they are excluded from a detail that only tabletop players are presumably the majority purchasers of? And then adding on to that, even if we were to qualify into this people who play the tabletop, you're still facing the fact that many of those who do so won't play that specific faction in question. So it's kind of a niche in a niche in a niche, and there's going to be a lot of people who are still quite interested in the broader lore. Now, I've got to say, all of this in isolation might make for reasonable points, but I think if we're being really realistic and reasonable here, we all know fundamentally that the chances of anybody who is very invested in 40k actually missing out on some important detail which is occurring is quite minimal, because we live in 2025 and the internet exists. So the chances really of missing out are quite non-existent. But I think you could also argue that were revelations to occur within a novel, you would also be in that same situation but reversed. Do tabletop players who enjoy the lore read every single novel? Probably not. Nonetheless, it still doesn't kind of feel like you're escaping the fact that you're sort of putting an important detail in this very specific place, and it just kind of doesn't feel right. I think the main argument for key lore appearing in novels rather than a codex is simply that you'd be more likely to get, like I said, additional supporting context, which is really important. On the other hand, saying that out loud, often in 40k novels you might be out of luck there as well, because details can be traditionally quite sparse, unless you're talking about the last chapter. But just putting how we deliver elements of lore aside, the question we've been left to discuss and answer is, should we place any weight in these new revelations regarding the Terminus Decree? So, is this new Terminus plausible, or for that matter even possible? And then this is where things get a bit speculative and a lot convoluted. Plus, I will say spoilers again for the Heresy and Siege of Terror stuff. But I won't bait you all out for some final reveal of my opinion. The answer really, for me, in should we place any weight into this is, in my opinion, no. Because I'm truly confused why they decided to add this definition of the terminus when we already had one which was well established. This new description really doesn't make sense however you cut it, and the entire situation is quite frustrating. I can make guesses, rationalizations, but I ultimately couldn't tell you why this felt to be necessary. It's just as I said in relation to the custodes, it feels like a neck-breaking U-turn. It's very jarring. It's like someone's literally just slammed the brakes on, changed gear, and you got whiplash. With all that said though, it is 40k, and in 40k, whether you like it or not, you could rationalize just about anything. So maybe they have some master plotline up their sleeve. And it must also be observed and reminded though, that the Codex books are often seen to be not really, how can I say, neutral repositories of lore. They're instead framed through the lens of the Imperium. And to be clear, that's not something which is officially stated. It's more that it's evidenced in their tone, remaining one of Imperial record keeping. It's of dossiers, battlefield reports, of a bureaucracy that's attempting to catalogue the history of the Xenos and the heretic factions. And even the Xenos codexes can be littered with Imperial perspective, which is why we see omissions, propaganda, misunderstanding. Now again, that's not official, it's more just something that people have observed over, really, decades. And so anything within a codex and not an official novel can, I think, be taken with a grain of salt. Nonetheless, I do want to rake over the why and also just explore the possibilities of the terminus options we have, because in exploring these, I think it is clearer why this new description can be discounted. I will say this though, I think this recent description as it relates to the terminus has inflamed people's opinions so much because it feels as if it's some kind of check as to whether people have been paying attention to the last decade of lore and the novels. I mean, it obviously cannot be that, but that's how it feels. To which the answer, of course, would be yes, yes, we have been paying attention, and that's why people are quite reasonably irate. Now, about 4 years ago, I had a video where I speculated about the terminus, and in that I ranged from the fact that the seal on it seemed to connect with that of the throne, and that in that perhaps this had some role as the ultimate exterminatus failsafe, or that it would be a command to finally release the emperor from the throne, which seemed more plausible, and enable him to then form in the warp and become like this true god emperor to challenge chaos, to use his power as he did during the crusade, to if not empower the Astronomicon, even just he himself to become a new lighthouse enabling travel, thereby just empowering his forces in real space. And I think now we can conclude that that is entirely wrong, but it seemed entirely plausible to me at the time given the status of the seal and the idea of what would you do in the most desperate times of humanity? Would you just roll the dice and say, let's unleash the Emperor and see what happens? So until this point, the Terminus Decree had never been revealed outright at all, and I question still whether it actually has been, because as it is understood with the lore, things can be established, and as I've said before, it doesn't necessarily make them true. And this takes more than a single statement or a point of reference. If you just have a singular statement from someone, a single reference, I don't consider that always to be absolutely solid, foundational as a point of lore, basically, because you need more in 40k, that's how it works. The largest and most significant obstacle to us in actually believing this new description about the Terminus is no secret at all now. It's the lore around Basilio Foe and his ultimate weapon developed in the last days of the Crusade, the implications of which are extremely hard to ignore, not just for us, but for those who put together this new Terminus description. We have in Basilio Foe an existing character in a key narrative who is this master of forbidden biotechnology imprisoned beneath the palace on Terra. He's tasked to obsessively work upon a weapon designed to end the Astartes and even the Primarchs, and it's referred to constantly as the Terminus Sanction. So fast forwarding to a Terminus Decree being spoken of as a sealed ultimate sanction locked in stasis on Titan, come on, it would be literally insane if this was not the resolution. And for anybody who wants to roll out the standard suggestion of, well, I guess this new law, it was written in by somebody who just didn't know about that, or they got the intern to write it. No, that's not how it works at all. Anything like this will have been checked and triple checked. So this new terminus description in the Codex is meant to be there as stated, 100%, which makes it all the more strange and debate worthy. Because I think for pretty much everybody, it seems abundantly clear that the Terminus Decree is none other than the final work of Basilio Foe, preserved in presumably data form as this last terrible failsafe the Imperium cannot afford to destroy, yet also dare not use. Now, almost inevitably, the man himself has relevance here. But before we go too far forward, I felt it necessary to establish something that approaches the current status of the Emperor. As I'm quite obviously known for going off the deep end a bit when it comes to tangents and the Emperor, I'm going to try and keep this locked down for today, because it's not the core of the matter at hand. And in actuality, I don't think we even need to overcomplicate things with wild ender speculatives for the purposes of this topic, interesting as they may be. So in terms of the Emperor, let's just say his existence is always challenging to define. We have a sense of what he is, but with the Emperor already being somewhat of an unknown quantity, even before he was installed to the Golden Throne, it certainly doesn't make things any easier, not to mention the long-standing ambiguity of his actual intentions. The Emperor is both an extremely powerful psychic being and a perpetual, that is to say, an immortal, a being like Vulcan who can be reborn, as far as we know, infinitely. Although perpetuals also do appear able to be killed permanently, as has happened to several of them throughout history and the events of the Heresy. But just what a perpetual is not heavily explored or defined. They could well be little more than very powerful psykers, although not all display this as an actual tangible ability. So it could be a more latent evolutionary trait. And what comes to mind most obviously is the Eldar. The Eldar were at one time all immortals. They were able to be reborn over and over, although in a slightly different way through reincarnation. Again, in terms of the Eldar, this is also something that exists in their deep history, and it is not specifically clarified. It's all to do with, I think, what we would loosely define as the soul of an individual. Some are more powerful, more resilient than others. Most humans, when they hit the actual warp, their soul just dissipates into nothing. But those who are more strong of soul and spirit are able to endure and last, like the Eldar, which is why Slaanesh always talks about holding their souls trapped for all eternity in the warp. And this means that some are able to survive in the warp and therefore return to material space. And I could go on and on about that, but I think, vague as it is, that's basically sufficient to understand. And there may also be other factors, like, for example, faith. When we think about figures such as Celestine, it may be that even if you are human, if you have enough faith, it kind of protects and empowers, shields your soul once it's into the warp, something like that. In terms of the Emperor, as has been described by Dan Abnett, the Emperor is trapped in this cycle of life and death upon the throne. Which, when you consider it, really makes a lot of sense, that he is perhaps trying to die and then being reborn, or maybe he is simply running out of energy, dying and then reincarnating upon the throne over and over and over. Meanwhile, all the psychic energy being fed to him through the throne device and the black ships, which have the Sisters of Silence, bringing psychers to Terra, this is just enough to enable him to function the Astronomicon and keep the door held to the Webway. So he's basically just hanging on by a thread. By the time Gilliman returns, the Emperor is all just but a husk. He's not even really anything of what he was. He's just this dissipated remains. However, we also know he's gaining significant power from the Cicatrix Maledictum and the explosion of human psychers, not to mention by M41, the immense amount of worship directed toward him, which is basically functioning at this point like a chaos god. All the faith and worship of the Imperium is just being fed into the Emperor. And although I don't think I've voiced this before, it's hardly a groundbreaking revelation to state that one of my long-held speculative positions is that due to the way in which the Emperor is now trapped upon the throne, I envisage him essentially straddling the warp. It's as if his spirit is torn between reality and the warp, where he exists somehow in both places at once. And maybe sometimes he's pulled more toward reality, and sometimes he's pulled more toward the warp. His corporeal form upon the throne is all but gone. It is being kind of held in place by sort of stasis and all the strange mechanisms of the throne, but really the core of what the Emperor is just being empowered by those psychers fed to him, his ethereal form there and in the warp. And then of course also those shards of himself which he separated prior to the battle with Horus, and those are believed to still exist somewhere in the warp. And again, we know from the Siege of Terra that the Emperor wished to one day potentially reconnect with those, making himself whole, as did Magnus with his own shards. But the Emperor put those aside in order to defeat Horus. He saw that as being a necessity. Some consider these to be part of the Star Child reincarnation theory, but I think it's more that the Emperor just imagined at some point he would become powerful enough to leave the throne and reconnect with those. So anyway, by M41, and to be clear, this is my full speculation here, the Emperor is effectively already functioning as a god of the warp. He is the God Emperor. Not the Dark King entity, of course, that was spoken to during the final chapters of the Heresy, which was in short where the Emperor began to just draw ever more power from the warp, something he'd long resisted doing, and he began to turn essentially into something that was headed toward being another Chaos God, where he himself was becoming so consumed by the power fed to him from the warp, he was starting to lose control and perspective. There's little more to this Dark King thread than that. You can discuss around it a lot, but basically, it's just that sense that he was losing control and taking too much power from the warp. And of course, that's kind of what the Cabal had long warned of, that there really wasn't going to be any true solution. One way or the other, Chaos was going to win. And arguably, in the long term, that's still possible. So only in the final stages of the Heresy was the Emperor able to be convinced by all to take a different path, to trust that he could defeat Horus without using the warp. And that's when he turned away from this path of the Dark King. But unfortunately, of course, although he ends up defeating Horus, he also ends up back on the throne. Now, in terms of where things stand in the contemporary Imperium, there are several markers which speak to his greater presence in the warp. Things like the Sororitas, for example. They're not psychic, but they appear able to use abilities comparable to psychers. They also are able to use these powers even when they're in a pariah nexus, like a null field. And that's suggesting that their powers are not strictly psychic, but something else. And again, remember, this was something that was annoying me because it's never been particularly explained how that exactly functions. So it's more like a faith-based channeling of the Emperor's power, which I think I find myself envisioning being more like orc psychic power or something like that. But the fact that now he also seems to speak and assert his power ever more, I think demonstrates that the Cicatrix Maledictum, or that faith, has been empowering him, and he is starting to become this more kind of present entity. Also, like, for example, in Dark Imperium, in Plague War, we see him burn the Garden of Nurgle in the warp, which that's not something that just anybody can do. You have to really be this significant power and present in the warp to be able to do that. So it demonstrates he has an actual presence, not just bleeding diffusions of power from the throne, from this, you know, his position on the throne. He's not just kind of influencing things in the warp. He would need to be there to be able to actually enact and use his power. But again, he's not like a full form because he's still tethered and trapped to the throne. So he doesn't have like the power of a god. He can just kind of perhaps save up his energy and then use it in specific places, which also makes sense when we consider the fact that individuals like the Sororitas will always be praying to the Emperor, always asking for his assistance, but it of course doesn't always come. And perhaps it only comes when it's this critical moment he's able to actually sense that it's needed and he has the actual power to be able to influence that moment. So what about this order to keep him on the throne? Why and when would the Emperor have given such an order to the Grey Knights at all? Why wouldn't he just allow himself to be removed from the throne and be reborn or coalesce in the warp as a god? We'll talk about that a little later on. In terms of the Terminus Decree, there are only three main sources to reference. The codexes themselves, the scattering of implications that are dotted throughout the Siege of Terror novels, and then the heresy novel The Buried Dagger. Importantly though, the codexes are the only place the Terminus Decree is mentioned definitively. Everything else is an implication, as is tradition for 40k. Now, most comments that I've seen are along the lines of, well, how could the Emperor give an order to the Grey Knights? Because Malkador was the one who set that up. And how could the Emperor, who was basically unable to then communicate after his battle with Horus, well, in terms of that specific situation, while the Siege of Terror series established this amount of detail regarding the Terminus Sanction, it was the final novel in the Core Heresy series, The Buried Dagger, by James Swallow. Incidentally, he also wrote Flight of the Eisenstein, which is the fourth book in the Heresy series, and one which you will know is one of my absolute favourites, so recommend that. But Buried Dagger established the foundation of the Grey Knights and the Emperor's orders to them, because yes, the Emperor speaks to the Knights Errant before they become the Grey Knights and travel to Titan with Malkador. The Emperor speaks to them in this novel. Unsurprisingly, also as one of the final novels, it is quite significant. We also see more of Malkador's operations in the depths of the palace, including these terrifying vaults which contain humans that are just too dangerous to be executed or left alive out in the world. So they're just put down here in these massive vaults contained hundreds of meters below the palace in this vast catacomb, which seems very typical of the Sigillite Order. And here we have Malkador meeting with his Knights Errant, and he sets each of them onto a new path. He releases Garrow to become basically independent and meet his ultimate destiny in the Siege of Terror, because Malkador doesn't see his future with the Grey Knights. He doesn't know exactly what's going to happen, but he knows he has to just let Garrow go. We also get more flavour from Malkador about the paths of fate, the configurations of time and reality. And again, I want to highlight, this is more confirmation in terms of the lore as to how time and reality functions in 40k. The idea that there are multiple timelines, but that doesn't mean that they all exist at the same time. It's not like the many worlds theory where you just have lots and lots and lots of, it's basically not Rick and Morty. You don't have just tons of different realities all existing at the same time. In 40k, you have timelines which converge into a single linear point at some time, but they're just potential options. Some, though, seemingly according to Malkador, cannot be stopped from coming to pass. There are some shifts, some tangents which you can make, but there are some things which seem set, which I really like, because this makes a lot of sense within the broader context of the lore as we understand it. You consider instances we know of, like Sanguinius, where the Emperor implores him to remain behind when he's going to go and fight Horus. He says, don't come and join them on the War Master's ship. Sanguinius explains that he must go with them, for that is his fate. He's seen it. He knows that he must be there. The Emperor finally concedes, because the Emperor also understands this is how things work. He has to be allowed to be there if he's meant to be there. And so he accepts that this is the determined end for Sanguinius, and it cannot be altered or prevented, which is what happens. And again, if I was going to do tangents today, I would do a whole tangent here about Eldrad Ulthran and the Harlequins and on and on and on. But it leads me off towards also the Dark Origin series, which I am in a place to finish now. Just, you know, gotta actually do that. But the most important thing is that we can understand a bit more about how time and reality works now, because it is really important within these kind of discussions. It's a combination of the theoretical models of time. It's both linear and eternal. And likely, this is to do with the way the warp interacts with real space, where in the Materium, we observe time as being linear. In the warp, it's eternalist. And this obviously creates some confusing complications, and something I won't try to unpick here and now. Like, for example, Slaanesh had to be created at this specific point in time that we understand, yet also Slaanesh, as soon as it was created, therefore existed for all eternity. How the hell does that work? I'll leave you to try and wrap your head around that. I think what will suffice is just how Malkador explains it, where he says, I have learned through bitter experience that the river of fate can be navigated, even diverted, but never halted. The wise man learns the currents, turns them to his own ends. And that really speaks to, I think, what the Emperor and Malkador were trying to do, which we already know. And so Malkador takes the knights to this secret chamber. They're having a meeting where they're talking about essentially what's going to happen, what's going to come next, and the Emperor comes in. He is talking, he's looking at each of them, and you get this sense that he's gazing into the soul of each of them. It talks about how he's pausing momentarily to sort of stare into the eyes of each of them. And as he reaches Loken and stares into him, Loken sort of has this disconnected moment where he sort of loses track of what is occurring in the room, and then he wakes from the moment, and the Emperor is gone. So there's some time missing in this moment because we get stuck in Loken's perspective. We don't see the Emperor speaking to everybody. We don't hear him also potentially giving any orders, but he very well could have done. And just because we're on the subject, this is where we have a favourite interaction of mine, similarly to as I mentioned with Sanguinius. We have Loken as this long-held, deep-seated feeling in himself that he was meant to meet Horus again during the final battle for Terra. So when the time comes for all the knights to leave for Titan, Loken resists. He refuses Malkador, and perhaps given the breadth of understanding that Malkador has, he acknowledges this. And instead of forcing the matter, as he leaves to accompany the knights and establish their purpose, Malkador's final words to Loken are epic, chilling, and bleak. He just states to Loken, without even looking back to him, "Horus will destroy you." It's surely a statement of fact, but I also take it as being quite resentful from Malkador, which I think gives rise to the question of him perhaps being uncertain or even wrong about how significant a role Loken would take in the final battle to come, and that perhaps Malkador believed Loken was more critical to the Grey Knights project. He certainly was ready to take Loken with him, so he couldn't have seen how important he would yet be for the Emperor. And that again is very interesting because it speaks about these configurations of time and the ability of the Emperor and Malkador to really see the future and all these kind of things. There's also the possibility, of course, that in the moment the Emperor looked directly upon Loken, he did see the significance and perhaps used his own will to have Loken refuse Malkador. Anyway, so to be clear, in the Buried Dagger, there is no direct instruction from the Emperor to the proto-Grey Knights of Malkador to carry out the Terminus Decree. There is nothing even suggesting that that occurs. But it is possible that in that instance, he could have done so. We know the Emperor can appear and effectively halt time within people's minds. He can take them on entire journeys without them ever leaving the room or the moment they're in. It's entirely plausible that could have occurred here as he peered into the very depths of each knight to ensure they were pure and strong enough for what was to come. We don't know. With this in mind, there is also another scenario, very speculative. Why do we presume that the Terminus Decree is a singular order? It's never been suggested that this is the case at all, but to my mind, it seems at least possible that there could be multiple Terminus Decree, each instructed to those foundational knights. To be clear, the lore has always stated that it was a singular order on a piece of parchment, which presumably originates from, if not this moment, then passed through time and, you know, really created along the way. But with something so mythical and shrouded in secrecy, and that we are now actively debating, we cannot say for sure. And I wouldn't have speculated to this degree previously were it not for the fact that we are now presented with this description of a Terminus order to return the Emperor to the throne, while it is simultaneously strongly established that Basilio Foe's Astartes killing ultimate weapon is, if not the actual Terminus, then certainly a confusing adjacent possibility. The only issue is that the Emperor could not have issued such an order, because in order to do so, he would have had to know definitively what scenario he would then face in the aftermath of the heresy, which was the entire problem at the end of the heresy and Siege of Terra. In fact, it seems fairly evident that the heresy was in fact so problematic because the Emperor did not have the clarity of foresight he apparently had elsewhere, and the same for Malkador. So then, it somewhat undermines the possibility, as I said earlier, of the Emperor just instructing those knights of Malkador before they travelled to Titan. unless the Emperor was just covering his bases. Because, of course, we know he is able to see these different configurations, which again is why I wonder, did he instruct each of them differently before they went to Titan? So, I think in terms of the Terminus Decree, let's take the position that what has recently been stated is in fact true, despite how inexplicable that may be. I think first of all, we have to ask who is giving us this information. The box itself has not been opened, so it's impossible that anyone in fiction is giving us this. That means it's coming from an invisible narrator. But this is also where the oddity of codexes raises its head again. As I said, codexes are a strange one in terms of diegesis, because it's often a weird combination of the extra-diegetic, diegetic and meta-diegetic. Essentially, in a codex, you're getting invisible narrators, in-fiction POV, and documentation, plus memories. And as we said, there's this curious habit of them tending to be seen from an imperial perspective. And it's often just confusing. For example, you may be reading what appears to be a pretty flat description of something like how a Space Marine chapter orders itself into companies. But then, thrown in there will be some words like, "Nay, they are necessary for the chapter's order." And so then you're suddenly thinking, wait, is this in fiction? Is this some kind of Imperial servant describing this to me? And that's the curious oddity with codexes. Often the information is unattributed to any specific character as well, so you've got no idea if it's in fiction or out of verse narration. With this most recent description then, it's hard to tell who the source describing this is, and that leaves us only able to then speculate about this. Essentially, with the way it's written, we have to presume that it's an extra-diegetic, invisible narrator. For one, because there's no overtly gothic language, which tends to be the case when it's written in fiction. Plus, it reads as more of a flat statement than a historical archive account. Now, that may not have been the intention. It may well have been intended as being, in fact, in fiction, penned by some adeptus scribe or whatever, but that's not how it reads. The why of this, I think, is pretty straightforward, but ultimately unnecessary. To my mind, it's just designed simply to underline the fact that the Emperor must remain on the throne forever, and little more than that. It's there to remind us that he must stay there and can't reappear in any of the forms that have been long speculated could occur by people outside of things, but also in fiction in terms of inquisitional factions. And again, all of that just feels unnecessary to me, because this was already all but evident. In fact, it seems like you could have explored and developed the lore surrounding the Emperor and the Golden Throne significantly more before making this blunt clarification that essentially says, yeah, he's got to stay in place. But of course, it's all the more curious when we know that even with this statement, he is already coalescing in the warp and is, from my perspective, torn between reality and the Immaterium. So, in terms of its context, it feels very fourth wall breaking because of how it's phrased. It's talking to us and not describing in a way that one might, for example, imagine being discussed between a leader of the Grey Knights, Gilliman, and the Lion in some closed door meeting where the Primarchs are like, okay, so what's the deal with this Terminus Decree? It doesn't come across like that. It's not phrased that way. There's certainly nothing to evidence anything other than an invisible narrator speaking directly to us, the audience, outside the verse. Which, for one, I don't like that personally, and two, it makes the specific choices included in the statement as a direct result now being read as even more pointed. Like, for example, how it says that the Grey Knights were created with the possibility of this event in mind. No, they weren't, and I would ask you to direct me to where this has ever been illustrated or otherwise stated before now. And also, where it says there's no guidance on how such feats might be achieved. I mean, sure, that makes all the sense in the world, but wouldn't you imagine that if the Emperor was going to give such an order, he would also add on to it, oh, sorry, forgot to also say, you need to go and get this ex-MacGuffin, because without that, you're basically trying to corral a god, and that's going to be basically impossible. I think the most acidic aspect, though, is not where it speaks about the custodians and having to fight them, which I feel like I really don't need to speak to that as a scenario, but instead it's the part where it says, for it is neither a weapon nor a magic formula. That is unashamedly a pointed knife twist at the revelations about Basilio Foe, which is either a deliberate undermining of established lore or an attempt to wink at the reader and tell us, hey, this description of the Terminus is not the one you're looking for, wink wink. So are we now in a situation where edition specific codexes are out here deliberately undermining the heaviest hitting material from the definitive series for 40k, the Heresy? Because if so, that is wild. But if it wasn't intended to do so, and it's kind of just like a dismissive wink to the audience, that's even more confusing. Ultimately, this Terminus description seems to me designed to be just a tool, like I said, to underscore the fact that the Emperor is staying where he is, and that any attempt for him to do otherwise will result in somehow him being dragged back there. So that's the why, in my opinion. Now, if we're talking about this more seriously as a concept, well, then you've got to ask the question, could the Grey Knights actually do it? Could they actually take the Emperor and return him to the throne? To which I think the answer is quite obviously no, because I don't think they could just return the Emperor to the throne. How do you do that? And then alongside that, like I just said, I don't think they would either need to cut a path through the ranks of the custodians either, for the simple reasoning that the Sigilite created the Grey Knights, and the custodians surely know that they're operating under the command and orders of the Emperor. And so if they roll up saying, hey, so the Emperor told us to do this, and present a physical order to that effect, I can't really imagine how the custodians wouldn't be on board there. But I think the question then becomes more, so what if they didn't, for whatever reason? What if the custodians acknowledged the order, but just disagreed? What if they didn't recognize the authority of the order? Or even if they said something like, we have to hear it from the Emperor himself, and so on. And sure, then you're going to have a big, big problem. Could the Grey Knights defeat the custodians? Some people are going to tell you it's an outright win one way or the other. I think it's debatable because honestly, given how variable the lore is presented to us in terms of the custodians, you could probably flip a coin on it. And make no mistake, the Grey Knights are insanely powerful. They're one in a billion individuals who are taught to face down demons with like no armor, wield immense power in their psychic abilities. However, they are still ultimately space marines. The custodians are space marine killers. They should be easily able to stop them. And the custodians are no strangers also to demon killing and anti-psyker themselves. On the other hand, they were locked down by psychic power when aboard Horus' ship, although admittedly in that scenario by extremes of psychic power. But I think it just demonstrates they are vulnerable. They're not just totally invulnerable to psychic effects. I think truly that fight would come down to however you wanted to swing it, and the Sisters of Silence are a thing, but they're diminished in M41. But let's just say though that they don't have the custodians as a big issue, either because they just agree or they're crushed. So what happens then? Well, then you've got the Emperor attempting to leave the throne. How does that happen? Does that happen instantly? Is it an explosion which destroys the Imperial Palace and he's born again into the warp, not as the Dark King, not a new god of chaos, but this god of light and human faith to fight and empower humanity to fuel the Astronomicon and gather the souls of humankind? I mean, quite honestly, that doesn't sound too bad to me. Nonetheless, then you've got the Grey Knights, they've got their orders. What are you doing? How do you drag a god from the warp back to the throne? I think your options are pretty thin. No immediate mechanism exists that really is springing to mind. Now, presumably, they would have to find and then search for some means of making that possible. How long's that going to take? Maybe the Eldar or the Necron could end up having a hand in this resolution. But again, how long are you taking to sort that out? And in the meanwhile, what's going on Terra? Is the Emperor becoming ever more powerful to the point that it becomes absolutely impossible to return him? There's a lot of moving parts here. And I think the only immediate break glass in case of possibility could be Malkador, in the sense that Malkador belonged to the faction, the Sigilites, who held unheard of nightmare weapons from and prior to the Dark Age of Technology. He has himself admitted to committing immense atrocities, and that aspect of his past always seemed troubling, even to himself. So it wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility that he has some bizarre ancient device or system that could corral the Emperor and drag his form back to the throne. Certainly Malkador will have roots into the throne room and the lower levels of the palace that the Grey Knights could likely use, bypassing the custodians altogether, very probably from Titan itself. We know that that exists from how they travelled there in the first place. So then, the bigger and more interesting question continues to be, would that order then end up becoming more suggestive that Malkador had more power ultimately than the Emperor? And this is this idea that Malkador is some kind of puppet master, which is something long speculated about with admittedly very, very little, if any, evidence. Also though, if such a strange machine or piece of technology existed that could actually do that and return the Emperor to the throne, you'd imagine it could basically contain and trap any immense psyche or warp entity, kind of like some kind of immense Ghostbusters trap or something. And then you're thinking, so would the Emperor just leave that around? Did Malkador hide it really well? Wouldn't the Emperor have wanted to make sure that was destroyed? Again, a lot of questions. And then I think the only other wild conspiracy theory worth throwing in the mix is the Chambers of Purity on Titan. In past codexes for the Grey Knights, it's described how within Mount Anarch, a great evil lies entombed here. What is it? Unknown. Now, you'd presume some kind of demon form, but it is unknown. And it goes on to speak about how could something possibly have entered here during its Titan's time in the warp before it returned to real space. Did something get past Malkador's defences and Archaeotech? The truth is supposedly in the so-called Iron Grimoire, which is the Grey Knights' only record of their founding, but what's contained within Titan is spoken of specifically as a prisoner. So could a dark entity have corrupted the ultimate final end goal, the Terminus? Well, whatever it is said to still be there. But one would imagine that if this were true, it would be well guarded and contained by the Grey Knights, because if not, I mean, what are they even doing? So the only perspective which makes any sense, and it is pretty out there, is the idea that the Order of the Terminus, as it is now established, almost makes more sense if it has been somehow twisted, distorted, and is in fact aiding the great enemy more so than it does the Imperium, because they don't want the Emperor to be this powerful spirit in the warp. So I'm left kind of wondering, Tzeentch, is that you hiding in Titan? Now, the final thought requires a pretty steady suspension of disbelief. From the perspective of, yes, it seems very plausible that the Emperor understood the implications of becoming the Dark King, the Eldar and the Cabal did. They foresaw that this would represent essentially the same path as it did for them. The unleashing of the Dark King would be the same as the creation of Slaanesh. The Emperor would become this dark being who consumed all human souls and scoured the galaxy. It would be the end of humanity. Now, with that in mind, it is not unreasonable to presume that the Emperor greatly feared this scenario, that he understood that this could occur, and that he doesn't even know himself how he could be held upon the throne. He just knows that it must happen. The Grey Knights would have to just use their initiative and abilities to figure it out, perhaps in coordination with the Inquisition and the Custodes to resolve it. If there is a god in the warp, if there is an entity in the warp, do they have their own free will? Are they able to determine their choices, or are they guided more by the faith, prayer, wishes, and so forth of those who follow them? This idea that they have more or less power depending on what is going on in real space, kind of like how the Chaos Gods have that problem as well. And so you are left to wonder, did the Emperor kind of realize that, and he didn't want himself to be able to exist in that state for an extended period of time? But really, you could just spin this out on and on and on, and that's half the problem, because the simple answer is, we just don't know. Now, here's where things on the one hand get somewhat more simple, but also more headache-inducing. First of all, we've been looking at this so far through the lens of 10,000 years. The Terminus became all apparent during the Siege of Terra, and many had long speculated, myself included, that some sort of doomsday weapon which could create some kind of major reset for humanity seemed the most plausible for the Terminus Decree. That's not a particularly masterful revelation, it's just pretty logical speculation. And I still believe that this was, in fact, what the Terminus appears to be. Except, it is not titled the Terminus Decree, this was the Terminus Sanction. More specifically, its purpose, the destruction of the Astartes. It is classified Tier XX as a Terminus Sanction. Basilio Foe and Malkador are these fascinating individuals. They're just a fractional example of humanity's true capability. They are something that then, when you look at what exists in the 10,000 years which come to pass later, are just by measures of degrees disappointing, if not wholly inadequate by comparison. And this, to me, is also the grinding darkness of M41. It's the depressing grimdark reality that humanity is operating little more than scraping around in the dirt compared to where it should be. It should be ascendant and glorious and all-powerful. This is what the Emperor wanted to see. Instead, it can barely cling on to the territory it has, with human worlds consuming themselves as readily as would the Xenos. Look at how Gilliman reacted when he came back in M41. He just went into this depressed malaise because Gilliman looked around and was just appalled at the horrifying misery and backward-reaching perspective of humanity in this era. It is nothing like the golden age that they were trying to usher in. So the creator of this ultimate weapon was one Basilio Foe. As far as records went, he was a figure who emerged from the wars for Terra's unification. He was a known figure among those era's warlords, but Foe feared the master of mankind. He believed his drive and the might of his newly forged transhuman warriors would ensure victory, but then lead to tyranny. This was the fear of many perpetuals, in fact. They believed the Emperor to be going too far too fast, and it's interesting how anybody who knew the Emperor before he was the Emperor rarely has a good word to say about him, which is something I always take time to mention, but then I just get called a heretic. Now, in Foe's mind, it was the Emperor's arrogance that would see Terra subjugated. Foe had been branded a criminal for the deaths caused by his creations, whatever, which is comical when you consider the horror unleashed by the Emperor and Malkador as they scoured the galaxy. In the fullness of time, Foe came to rule a distant world of Velik Tarn, unchallenged until the Great Crusade arrived under Horus's fleet, and Foe unsurprisingly resisted compliance. He did not wish to be part of the Emperor's plans. Foe relished the freedom of human independence, and yes, that meant biomechanical, genetically forged horrors, but you know, he's got his own things going on. And yes, he would unleash those in a battle that almost slew the Primarch Horus, but they ultimately triumphed, so it was all fine. Foe was then sent back to Terra and cast into the Imperial dungeon, where his hatred for Horus unsurprisingly festered, and he began plotting elaborate ways to kill him when he would escape. Malkador quite obviously understood the quite extreme danger in Basilio Foe, but he also had a habit of holding on to things in case he needed them rather than just purging them, which is what happened. Much later, during the Siege of Terror, Foe was interrogated by custodes Amon, Kyrel Sinderman, and Euphrates Keeler under Malkador's newly formed Order of Interrogation. Now, technically, this is just another Order of Remembrancers, but to my mind, this was in fact the earliest proto-iteration of the Inquisition, because they're seeking ultimate truth, really at any cost, to ensure imperial domination. Foe claimed he could craft a virus capable of killing space marines and even Primarchs, like Horus. Given the situation at the time, now seeing a possible solution to salvation, Amon authorized Keeler and Sinderman to explore the feasibility of his ideas. And Foe deliberately began to reveal his knowledge only in fragments, because he was a genius of a different age, and unlike the somewhat cattle-like humans who followed, Foe was able to seemingly operate far above ordinary humans. He was much more like Malkador, and his aim was to escape, but he did not expect this to take the form of a Selenar priestess known as Andromeda 17, because they were the genetic masters of Luna, and they obviously hated Foe for his absolutely abhorrent practices. Nonetheless, now Foe roamed the Palace of Terror. He was nearly slain by a traitor Night Lord, but saved by Valdor, and then taken back into Amon's custody. Foe would be later escorted to what appeared to be his execution, but in a flawless example of the problematic nature of the custodes, he was able to cripple Amon through nothing more than just the power of words. And again, it illustrates the initiative of those from a different age, and Foe was able to just continually undermine the confidence of Amon, sowing doubt about the legitimacy of his order, thereby forcing Amon to just halt the handover. They soon encountered a chosen of Malkador known as Xanthus, and again Andromeda 17. They sought a secure location for Foe to complete his work in the most urgent of moments. The pressure from the siege on the palace was reaching its endpoint, and within Malkador's laboratory, Foe was able to perfect the virus so it would kill only Astartes, theoretically. Now, the story of Foe gets very bizarre at this point, but it again underscores the ability of those from this era. For once the weapon was complete, Foe seemingly murdered Xanthus. Having already harvested his genetic material, was then able to rapidly clone and somehow inhabit this form of a new Xanthus body. Amon then killed Foe's original form, believing him ended. In actuality, the disguised Foe lived on, having adopted Xanthus as his new identity. By M32, Basilio Foe still lived, and now operated as one Inquisitor Xanthus, a radical who defended the use of warp powers without corruption. Accused of chaos worship, he was believed to have been burned for heresy, yet his doctrine, later called Xanthism, persisted as a dangerous and enduring ideology. And given his skills and ability, the question has always remained, did Foe actually die? The most revelatory piece of reference you'll want to read related to this is within The End and the Death, Volume 2, Section 6.16, Truth and Lies. And here we get the most complete description from Foe, and begin to understand that what had originally been a method to eradicate all Astartes has been further refined at the behest of Malkador. It also has Foe realizing that he completely underestimated the nature of humanity, that in his time he looked at things from purely the physical, the genetic, and not anything that resembled the spiritual. But he ultimately admits now that these things are interlinked, and the warp and humanity cannot be separated. They are one. He even highlights the fact that Malkador has criticized the Emperor many times over for not speaking to the dangers of the warp more vocally, at least just to the Primarchs, all of which continues to make Foe this very interesting character and adds more weight to the significance of his Terminus Sanction. Now, I think I barely need to speak more to this. The Terminus Sanction, the final, ultimate order that must be given to save humanity by exterminating the Astartes, both in the material realm and the warp, that's your full reset. It's the last break glass weapon to use when all hope is lost. And I do realise that this would create problems of its own, because without the Astartes, how do you stand up to the Tyranids, the Necron, and so on? And perhaps that's the only thing that does diminish this as the Terminus and add more weight to something like the description of it having to return the Emperor to Terra. Nonetheless, the presence of Chaos remains very real, and some would argue that it's this which is the inescapable existential threat to all of humanity. So, ordinarily, when you have such a long-established, decades-long novel series like The Heresy, and then just throw in some wild offhand lore spice in a tabletop rulebook, it can just be dismissed as the lucid imaginings of an Adeptus Terra scribe. But when it's some factionally defining important lore, supported with little if any context or further exploration, it becomes harder to hand-wave, and therefore more problematic. It would be like discovering in just any random Space Marine codex a small, totally out-of-context description about the missing legions, just tucked away on page 27, detailing in less than a paragraph why they were destroyed and by whom, and you're like, whoa, what? Why is this here? Is this official? Why is this here? And I've said many times, if you really want the full lore of 40k, you need to be not just getting the novels, but the codexes and the campaign books, because the campaign books often wildly contain more revelations than an entire trilogy of novels, which has long been absolutely incomprehensible to me, but there it is. Now, I fully accept if you're not wanting to play 40k as a game, then needing to buy material where only a third of the book itself contains the actual lore, that's not necessarily always going to be super attractive. The bottom line for me is that if what's written in this Grey Knight's Codex is left to stand forevermore, what that means is that basically you now have two storylines that contradict one another, one of which is embedded in the end series of The Heresy and is wrapped deeply into multiple books. I just don't believe that in the long term it can be left to stand as it is, because surely for those authors of The Heresy, the existence of something like this just kind of undermines an important woven thread within a narrative that represents decades of novels, and I might venture to even suggest a life's work for some. I struggle to see how that can be seen as anything other than being very problematic. Now, do I imagine that this is going to be vocally clarified and removed later? No, because that's never how 40k works. Now that it's out there, it's just going to always be out there, because once you put something in writing in 40k, it is there. And as you know, despite people claiming that things get retconned, I'll say it, they never really are. They're just reframed, they're alternatively spoken of. The fact that this description exists now means that it always will, especially given that the Grey Knights are essentially anti-demon, anti-warp Astartes, but they're still ultimately only Astartes. They are extremely elite, but they're highly specialised. They've been given an absolute thrashing on several occasions by Angron, for one, and so you're left thinking, well, if they can't really handle a demon Primarch, what hope would they have against the Master of Mankind in his ethereal ascended form? It's just frustrating when we already had the matching pieces, and then suddenly somebody slaps down a completely different puzzle piece that doesn't match at all. I've said for the longest time, as you know, that things can change in 40k. It's the nature of the beast, and this can be a positive, it can also be problematic. So sometimes you end up with situations like this. But the very nature of 40k also means that it remains open to interpretation. So for myself, until it's absolutely carved into stone and spoken to us through the actual novel format, the Terminus Decree remains the preserved culmination of Basilio Fo's work, for me. Because the Terminus has and is always spoken to as an order of last resort, a sealed weapon the Grey Knights alone might one day unchain. Neither of which fits an order saying, put him back on the throne. Plus, isn't it entirely more 40k to have the Terminus originate from a man who feared and disliked the Emperor, despised his sons, encoded Dark Age genetic annihilation as a direct counter to the Emperor's misadventure? To me, the Terminus was a last resort weapon, because the very necessity of having such a weapon in the first place was an acknowledgement that the Imperium's greatest assets were also its greatest liabilities, which is once again a perfect framing of the horror of 40k. The Emperor's angels, the guardians of all humanity, they are in fact the real monsters. The Terminus then should exist not as the final hope for the salvation of all. It exists to destroy and purge that which cannot be controlled. Or in other words, it represents the greatest fear of what humanity could, or perhaps has, already become. Thank you.